Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
I have watched a great many people come in with a very embryonic dream, or come in with a gift that they set aside 20 years before. And I have watched them in the course of 12 weeks change a great deal. But if they keep working with the tools, the difference at about 3 years out, I had a guy, I once taught this circle in Chicago that was all, actually I'll tell two funny stories. Every time you teach a circle, there's a group mind in the room. Sometimes the issue is money. But I once taught one circle of therapists, their group mind was sex. That was what was their most common block, their most passionate interest, their collages were full of it. And another circle that I taught was, for whatever reason, lawyers and stockbrokers and this was like, talk about straight. And this guy came into the circle, Richard, and he was a judge. And before being a very successful judge, he had been a very successful lawyer. However, as a little kid, he had wanted to be a sculptor. But his dad was a cop. And he came from a really tough Chicago neighborhood. And he had that same kind of artists are sissies, you know. A lot of sexual baggage often gets attached to creativity. Well, that was 5 years ago. Richard is still a very successful judge. He also has his own sculpture studio. He's a good sculptor. He's written two awfully good screenplays. Creativity is the damnedest thing because you may enter into the artist's way wanting to unblock one particular thing. You may be coming in so that you can let yourself sit at the piano without weeping. And then you find yourself in the third or fourth week rearranging your living room, and you start carrying a sketch pad, and all of a sudden you're taking a Japanese cooking course. People do the strangest, most wonderful things. And it is not too late. It is not too late. I sometimes get sent pictures of the painters who have not been letting themselves paint, and now they're letting themselves paint. And I'm looking at these and thinking, I cannot believe that this person did not do this for 25 years. How could they have not known? The thing that we are afraid of is, so I unblock myself and then I do bad work, right? That's what we're all frightened by. I get unblocked, I put it out in the world, it's terrible and I don't know it. Everyone else knows it. I make a fool out of myself. And we really would like some kind of net. We want some kind of guarantee that if we do bother to unblock our creativity, we will make good things. It's not really such an interesting question. What if I do bad work? That's just one of those little tricks that keeps us from doing the work. The real question is, you know, we look at the art that's out there now, and don't we occasionally say, I could do that better? Well, we're right. Also, very often it is not talent, it is audacity that moves somebody more center stage. Some of the most gifted people that I have taught have had the least self-worth about their gifts. So the more interesting question is not, will I be bad? And what a tragedy that is. The real question is, what a tragedy it is if I have the authentic gifts and I have not been able in this lifetime to use them. That's the real question. You know, what if I was really meant to do this book, and I could never support myself enough to let myself do it? What if I really let the crippling keep me crippled? And so when I'm in a room like this, it's, for me anyway, the kind of experience that, you know, when people talk about they can see spirit guides and auras and angels, and I always think they must have the most interesting time in a movie. You know, how do they even see the screen? But when we are in a room like this, one of the things that I have learned to know is that we are not alone here. It's not just our bodies that are here. It's all of the work that's meant to move through us. Each person has 5 or 6 things, or maybe 33, kind of queued up behind him going, listen to that, Ken. Listen to that. Do those morning pages, Fred. Because they do want to move through us. And it's natural for us to let them do that.
I can imagine that people might feel that it's arrogant to claim, I'm an artist, I'm a writer, I'm a painter, I'm a musician, to make that kind of statement when you've never achieved any kind of professional acclaim. What's the difference between arrogance and hopeful thinking and inspirational thinking?
Let's start with, is it arrogant to think that I am an artist? I would say no. I think it's the story of Rumpelstiltskin. If you are waiting for someone else to come along and say your name and say, Rumpelstiltskin, you're an artist, you might wait a very long time. I'm thinking of the writer William Kennedy. His book, Iron Legs, was submitted 49 times and rejected. It was accepted on the 50th try. Now, was he any less a writer during the years of submissions where people were finding terrible things wrong with the book or this reason or that they couldn't publish it? He didn't have the validation of the culture yet that he was a real writer. A real writer being a published writer, a real painter being a bought, shown painter, but he was very much the artist already. My belief is that what makes you an artist is, are you practicing your creativity? Not, is your creativity being recognized in society? I think we are so attached to the results of our creativity that we don't allow ourselves the joy of practicing it, of doing the watercolor because we like doing the watercolor. We want to know, is it worth it to me to do this? Meaning, will other people validate me for doing this? Not, do I find joy? Do I find satisfaction? We tend to confuse what are the odds of my getting this movie made with, would I enjoy trying to craft a film script?
You mentioned that creativity is in every human being's blood.
Mm-hmm.
But don't you think that some people are more talented than others? They're born more talented.
That might be true. But I think that there are an enormous number of people who are extremely talented and their talent has never been developed. If you go back to the parable of the seed of creativity sometimes falls on fertile ground. The individual has a supportive family, meets an appropriate mentor, is able to find support and guidance. But sometimes the seed of creativity is in someone whose family is terrified of their creativity. And that person can be punished for expressing creativity. And it has nothing to do with the strength of the gift. Nothing to do with that. It has to do with how the gift is received. And when you talk to people who have fulfilled artistic creative careers, you will often find them saying, I probably couldn't have done this except that my father said to me, you can do this. I probably couldn't have taken my piano except that my mother always made the time for me to have the lessons and found the money for it somehow. And what I am trying to do is encourage people to believe, to act as if they have real talent. You know, we do a wonderful job of acting as if we don't. And we say things like, well, there's so much terrible art out there. What if I unblock my creativity and I'm bad at what I do? Well, I think that's a chance you take. But the real question is, what if I'm genuinely as gifted as I secretly hope I might be? What if the tragedy of my life is that I have never had the courage to act on these dreams? So the much more interesting question, rather than looking at, aren't there some people who are geniuses, is to take a look at, aren't there many of us who have creative dreams and creative longings and creative talents that we have been too crippled, too frightened, too shy to express? And when we talk about, isn't it arrogant to say I'm an artist, actually, creativity is not an act of the ego. Creativity is allowing your normal spiritual blood to do what it's meant to do. The ego is where our blocks to creativity come from, because the ego says, well, I only want to do this if other people are going to think it's good. I only want to do this if I'm going to make a living at it. I only want to do this if nobody's going to make fun of me. That's the ego. The part of you that creates is the part that says, wouldn't it be fun? I'd really like to. It's a much more festive, childlike part, and it comes from a very pure source. And all of us have that. All of us have experienced getting immersed in a project. A mother is sitting at the table making Christmas tree ornaments with her little kids. She gets lost in that process of folding the strips of paper and making stars. And that is creativity. So we tend to have a lot of confusion about officially sanctioned creativity, important creativity, and that other stuff, which is just what we do in our life. When you begin to unblock your creativity, it doesn't just unblock in the desired area. You will find yourself rearranging your living room furniture, painting your house a different color, changing your wardrobe, cooking something different on Thursdays. It's a very multifaceted thing.
Now, you put a lot of emphasis on the morning pages. Do these work the same on sculptors, musicians, visual artists, filmmakers, as they do on people who are writers? I mean, this is a written medium, the morning
pages. I think writers have a terrible time with them sometimes. I think writers are damned by their notion that somehow these should sound like writing or they should be art. And I think that people who are visually talented have often been told that they can't write, and that in America we have this notion that if you're good in one thing, you're not going to be good at another. So we have painters who don't realize that they are wonderful poets, and poets who can paint but won't let themselves. And yes, the pages work for everyone. Writers do have to learn to drop the rock and let themselves just do. I initially called morning pages brain drain, because they really are not about art. They are simply about siphoning off our negative thoughts, our distractions. They really are a form of meditation. When you do a sitting meditation, you have what we call cloud thoughts that just pass by, and we learn to watch these thoughts without attachment. It's the same thing. I'm just asking you to write your cloud thoughts down. So yes, they work for everybody. Writers may have a little bit of a surrender when they realize, I don't sound that much like a writer in these. And occasionally, people sound brilliant. There's no rule about them.
What gets into people's way on a daily basis? One thing, it seems, would be, well, the reason I didn't do it today was that I didn't have enough time. Mm-hmm. Today was a bad day for me. I was very busy. I had an 8 in the morning appointment. Couldn't get those morning pages done.
Mm-hmm. I think that people have difficulty making themselves their own priority. People are afraid of being selfish. People are afraid of clarity. there are a certain number of blocks that are sort of round up the usual suspects. Today you are mm-hmm. going to tell yourself that you did not work on your creative project because A, your husband took all your time. B, your friend was in crisis. C, you had committed yourself to which worthy community cause. D, your children needed you. And we can really find on any given day 9 or 10 excellent reasons to not sure. be creative. And what I am suggesting is that if people will work with 3 pages of longhand morning writing every day, that they will then begin to prioritize their days in ways that serve their interests better. They will find themselves getting off the phone with the friend who is the stuck record, who has been complaining about the same bad relationship for the last 3 months, an hour and a half a night, to you. They will find themselves saying, I'd love to see you, Anne, but today I'm going to painting class. People begin to create a sacred circle for themselves. They begin to be able to draw different boundaries. And most of us overbook our lives. We are filled with concern for others, and we keep ourselves so busy, so frantic, so overcommitted, so helpful to others, that we do not hear the still small voice, we strangle it. And that taking 15 minutes in the morning to record how things feel to you is actually a very threatening process for people. I'm delighted to report that it's also a positively addicting process, and that once people work with these pages, even for a little while, they begin to notice enormous shifts in the way they move through their days, in the way they structure their time, because they know now what's important to them. They're no longer trying to bury their dreams or their irritations or their needs. They are becoming intimate to themselves.
You mentioned that when people start writing the morning pages, they notice a certain amount of synchronicity beginning to occur in their lives. What do you think creates this synchronicity?
In the process of morning pages, people are talking to themselves, and they are also talking, if you will, to the universe. I don't really care what language you want to put on it. People can say they're talking to God, they're talking to their higher self, they're talking to the universe, they're talking to the flow. The point is, they are talking, and something is listening and responding. And I have a bumper sticker on my car, which is a great favorite of mine, which is clarity is power. As we come to clarity about our desires, our wishes, our dreams, our hopes, our frustrations, events move towards us. And I've watched this over and over. Someone will say, I've realized that I'd love to take a pottery class, but they don't have those here. And then a week later, they'll come back and say, do you remember I mentioned I wanted to take a pottery class? I was at the laundromat. The lady sitting next to me, she just moved here. She's a potter. She's going to teach classes. And they say this with this astounded voice. And I am so used to seeing and hearing these tiny miracles. So when you ask me, what causes synchronicity? We cause it. We cause it by committing to being true to ourselves, by committing to being honest enough to admit what we would truly like. And it is my belief that the universe is a user-friendly sea mm-hmm. that we are floating in, that it is responsive, it is interactive. It hears our prayers, it hears our desires, it supplies our needs, and that frequently we experience it as an erratic or hostile place because we're not admitting what we want or what we need, and we're keeping it a secret from ourselves, And then when we are thwarted in the outside world, we're using that as proof that, well, see, none of this ever works out. But we've never made the commitment to find out if it could work out. We're always talking ourselves out of projects. We're always finding the reasons why we can't do things. We're always trying to say, well, exactly how would I do that? As though we're the only power that there is. As though if you don't happen to live next door to the president of a movie studio, you'll never get a film made. Mm-hmm. We don't give the universe a chance to act in our behalf. The minute that you begin to forge a relationship, creative person to creator, the minute you begin to like put it out and say, just maybe, we call God the creator, and creator is the word for artist. Just maybe the universe will respond to my creative urges. The minute you begin experimenting with that, you will see a response. Essentially, the artist's way is a scientific method. I ask people to do these things. There are 120 separate tasks in the book. If people do these things, a great change will occur. If people talk about doing them, think about doing them, and don't do them, change will not occur. Change begins with inner commitment, with risk. And it starts with tiny amounts of risk. Just risk writing 3 pages today. Don't worry about if you'll do it tomorrow. Then the next day, just risk 3 pages today. Once a week, risk taking an artist date. Take an hour or 2 hours to yourself and go do something interesting. When people do that, they begin to hear the urgings of their intuition, of the still small voice, of the artistic impulse. They find themselves thinking, wouldn't it be fun? And then their censor will say, oh, but you can't do that. What the morning pages do is train a person to get past that voice that says, you can't do that. Every day that voice will chat at you in the pages. Every day you get a little stronger at saying, oh, there you go again, censor, chatting away, telling me all the negative reasons. When the censor becomes miniaturized into a negative character, a sort of very familiar wet blanket with bad attitudes who never has any fun, when you begin to hear your censor that way instead of as the voice of reason, you're free to take many risks, and they start out small, but over time they make an enormous difference. I want to talk about a tool called the jealousy map. Very often people are in denial about what they would really like to do. And I will say to them, okay, write down the names of 20 people that you're jealous of. And people will look at me with horror and they'll go, I'm not jealous, Julia. I couldn't be. Well, all right, write down 20 people you envy or resent, or or if you let yourself, you'd kind of admit that you have a little sour feeling around. And they manage to come up with a list of names. And then I say, all right, now make another column and say, why do you resent them? For example, if you have 6 or 7 actresses on your list of 20, well, that's a big clue. This is why we call it a jealousy map. It's a big clue that you have a hidden desire to act. If you have 3 or 4 people there who are playwrights, you may have a play that's wanting to be born, and you're not admitting that you're a blocked playwright. The minute you start to have clarity around some of these subconscious, internal clusters of negativity, when you bring these to consciousness, synchronicity can begin to enter the picture.
Maybe one of the things that's scary is to admit that you're jealous of someone like the President of the United States or one of the wealthiest people. People don't want to admit that they're, you know, jealous of the people at the greatest heights, yet they are.
I want to talk about another tool that's fun. I ask people, if you had 5 other lives, what would you do? And someone says, what? What do you mean? And I say, well, if you had 5 other lives, would you be a prophet, a healer, a bareback bronco rider, a trapeze artist, a filmmaker, a happily married wife and mother, a minister, a car repair person. What sounds like any fun at all? A torch singer? I would be a torch singer in another life.
I was going to ask you what your five other lives were.
And then I say, okay, now take a look at your current life. Have you got any of these going on? And so if someone has put down, I'd love to be a cowboy, the next question is, do you ever see a horse? No, but I've always wanted to learn how to ride. Is there any place in town where they give riding lessons? Well, yes. Well, could you sign up for riding lessons? So you take a look at what the buried dreams are, and then you begin to move toward them in your current life. The torch singer could take singing lessons, could at least allow a nice record collection. A lot of times we can't have the full-fledged version. You know, if a fellow at 45 would truly have loved to be a lead guitarist, he could get at least an acoustic guitar, go down in the basement, and fool around with it. But a lot of times we won't let ourselves have even the smallest smidgen of a dream. So really what I work with people about is let's admit some of the dreams and let's start letting us have small daubs of them. And what we find happens is that as you move toward a dream, the dream also moves toward you. It meets you. Mm-hmm.
What do you think happens to people if they don't express their creativity? Do you think they get ill, addicted, bored?
All of the above.
All of the above.
Ill, addicted, bored, angry, frustrated, resentful, stymied, convinced that the world is out to get them or is hostile, negative, stuck. And I think that when people do express their creativity, they find themselves getting a little bit hopeful, a little bit cheerful.
Can you recognize a blocked artist walking down the street? Can you see something in their face? Oh, yep, there you go.
You mean from a distance of 30 paces, do I know one?
Yeah.
I think that I can feel it when I'm with one. And I think that people who work with their creativity begin to realize when they're in the presence of blocked people that their body starts to register, gee, there's something here that doesn't feel quite right. And I think similarly, when people have been working with their creativity and they are in the presence of other people who are also working with theirs, there's a kind of light electricity that happens that's very joyful. And it does have a certain signature to it. You do recognize it. I am not alone in this. I think anybody working with their creativity begins to recognize it and feel it when someone else is too.
How have you helped people get over their fears about money in relationship to their creativity? You know, this is all great, Julia, but I've got to support the kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I say, did I tell you not to support those children? And then I say, okay, let's start working with some real practical tools. One of the things I have people do is list 20 things they enjoy doing. Then I ask them to list, when was the last time you did each one? And if you look at those lists, a lot of the things on the list do not cost a lot of money. You know, if you own a bike and bike riding is among your favorite things, you don't have to put down a 10 spot every time you go to get on the bike. So I get people to take a look at the number of activities that they could be doing that don't entail a lot of money. Then I have them do an exercise called counting. I have them record money in, money out. For example, you'll have somebody saying, I can't go to the theater, I'm broke. And then in their counting, they realize that they buy, oh, $36 a month or more worth of magazines, which is theater tickets at least twice. So they do the money in, money out without judgment, but they begin to get a map of where their money goes. And I ask them to work with making lists of what things feel luxurious to them. For example, raspberries make me feel spoiled rotten. I love raspberries. If I let myself have raspberries, which max out at about $4.50, and sometimes in season they're $1.59, I once saw them for $1.19. If I have raspberries, I tend to think this is a pretty abundant universe. But many people systematically deprive themselves of things that they do love, saying that they are too expensive, and spend their money on things that they don't love and don't need. And essentially what they are doing is medicating their need for life changes by making home improvements. It's similar to kind of quietly closet drinking. You never look outrageously drunk, but you're always sort of financially tipsy, a little bit off balance, living just beyond your means. And one of the things that I did was write a whole book about money with a friend of mine, Mark Bryan. And we looked at money through the lens of chemical dependency because we recognized that many people work with prosperity thinking and abundance thinking and use a lot of metaphysical tools and a lot of fiscal tools, and their money is still wacko. And this is a problem. If you are worrying about paying the rent, you are not flying to Paris to visit all the paintings that you would like to look at. You're not even signing up for your painting class. You aren't buying art supplies. So we wrote a book called The Money Drunk, and it looks at money through the lens of chemical dependency. And we found that some people have a very toxic relationship, that money is really mood-altering for them. It's one more chemical. And you have binge spenders, the compulsive spender, like the person who goes out on a big weekend drunk. You have the cash codependent, who's like the Al-Anon wife, signed up with the compulsive spender and is always trying to control the partner's spending and money madness. You have the poverty addict, somebody who really feels that it's virtuous to be poor. And oftentimes, poverty addiction is sort of leftover 60s virtue, where you are actually just as obsessed about money and how you don't have it and you don't need it and you don't want it, and you judge those that do have it as the people that you're judging, who are always worrying about how to get a little bit more of it. And then we found there was the maintenance money drunk, which is the person I was talking about before, always medicating the life with, I'll get a new CD player rather than let myself take singing lessons. I'll get myself a new bathroom rug rather than let myself get hiking shoes so that I can go up the mountain. And that book has an enormous number of tools in it which people can use on a very practical level to work with addictive, toxic money relationships. But a lot of times, Tammy, when people say that money is the issue, they aren't willing to take the small first step. They say, I'll never have enough money to make a film, therefore I won't even work on a script. They are, again, one more time, way out there in the results rather than back with, do I have enough cash to take an acting class? Let's start with the acting class before we're buying the condo in L.A.
Let's say you have an artist, though, whose problem is not being unblocked. They're producing a lot of material. Mm-hmm. But their frustration is, I don't have the money to send my slides around because I just can't make any additional copies of the slides. I don't have any extra money. Or I can't frame my pictures and put them up in a gallery because I can't afford the framing. Mm-hmm. I keep painting and painting, and I'm running out of money for paints. Mm-hmm. Their creativity is on a roll, but they don't have enough money for their supplies.
Mm-hmm. And they've never heard of the barter system. One of the things that happens when you begin working with Morning Pages and you begin working perhaps with a creative cluster is that we often think, in order to have this, I have to pay cash on the barrel head. When people begin to say, is there some other way I could get these framed? I have a friend who's a fine woodworker, perhaps since he is a bachelor and I am a fabulous gourmet cook as well as a painter, I could make 6 Tupperware things of great vegetarian lasagna and he could do 6 frames for these paintings. When people begin to be creative around how to meet their needs instead of playing the victim around, oh, if I just had more cash flow, then it could happen. What we're talking about most of the time when we're talking about money is we want the power to do something. And money isn't the only source of power. You can barter for things. You can learn to do some of these things yourself. You can write letters and say, do you need slides in order to see my work, or would these 35 millimeter shots be adequate for you? You don't always get an immediate positive, but you would be astounded when you are willing to allow your source of supply to be multiple instead of singular. I need to earn enough money so I can buy this. What about saying, I need to have this done, and I'm open to having it done by any means that the universe gives me? That's where synchronicity comes in. I can't afford to fly to New York, but I need to go to New York. Well, I run into someone who needs to have a car driven to New York. Looks like you can get to New York. So a lot of times we call the block money, but it's really that we haven't made a full commitment to having something happen. And when we make the commitment to having something happen, the means for it to happen begins to show up. But again, when we talk about it, it's theory. When you work with the tools, it's experience.
Julia, I can imagine that some people might buy the Artist's Way book and they might begin it and start doing some of the exercises, but halfway through, a third of the way through, you know, they would stop. They'd put the book back on their shelf and they would never finish the 12-week course. Why do you think that happens, that some people start and then stop?
There is an incredible amount of fear in some people connected to working with these tools. There are two fears. Fear number one is, what if these don't work? Fear number two is, what if these work? And people's dreams are very painful when they are not actualized. There's a Michael Weller play called Ghosts on Fire. It's about a black director. And I've always thought that the title referred to the dreams, that when we have dreams that we have not actualized, they are ghosts on fire. And that when we even run our hand somewhere in the vicinity of the dream, when we turn our consciousness toward the dream at all, we can get real voltage, real shocks of pain, and oh my God, I can't look there, and I can't deal with this, and I can't do this grieving. I cannot look at how much I want that. I just don't want to think about it. And I think that people are very frightened of finding out, of turning around and admitting that they want something and taking the actions to move toward it. And I think that the resistance that people have around these tools has to do with the amount of pain that we have around our unadmitted dreams, our forgotten dreams, our buried dreams, our ignored dreams. And I want to say that dreams don't go away, and that if we do not tend to them, they go to our grave with us. They do not go away. At 80, if you wanted to write a novel at 20, you will still be carrying that unborn novel with you. And that people intuitively know this. And people are frightened. People are very frightened. Sometimes people will buy the Artist's Way book and then it'll sit on their table. And sometimes, as you said, someone will start the book and then they'll stop at about the third week when I mention a tool called reading deprivation. A lot of us use reading or television to medicate ourselves in the evening so we aren't alone with our own thoughts. We're always taking in other people's thoughts. So I ask people to do a fast, and for 1 week, do not read, watch TV, listen to talk radio. And they get very angry and they say, Julia, I'm an adult and I must stay grounded in the world. I'm an adult too and I must stay grounded in the world. But putting aside other people's opinions for 1 week brings them in contact with their dreams and with their wishes and their hopes and their disappointments and their angers. And people are frightened that this will be a tidal wave, that it'll roll toward them, it'll overwhelm them, it'll decimate them, that their rage when they look at how they have set aside their dreams because of other people's agendas for them or because of their own fears, that their rage will have them out buying submachine guns, that their rage will have them burning down the houses of the teachers that have thwarted them. And that's not my experience. My experience is that the rage is like a wave, but it's not like a tidal wave. It's something that does move through us. Then we're given that little rest in the trough between waves, and then another wave moves through us. And that we do need to do the grieving around the lost dreams, and that we are then given opportunities to pick the dreams up and to move forward with them. And this is what is really frightening. People would rather believe I do not have enough money. They would rather believe it is too late and I do not have enough time than take the risk of moving toward this dream again and becoming heartbroken again. So when I go in to teach a class, I always see in the first week incredible pain, incredible fear. I have people write down their pains and their fears, and it'll be funny. I mean, it'll be, if I'm looking straight and wearing a navy blue dress, I'll get a card that says, "This woman is too straight to know anything about being an artist." If I'm in more relaxed, quote, artistic garb, people will say, "This woman is too much of a flake. She can't teach me anything." People will look for a way to disqualify me and my tools because they are afraid of using them. But I do want to say that one of the tools in the book is, how do you move into something you're afraid of? You list your fears, you list your angers, and then you'll find yourself much more able to move into it. And that tool's called Blasting Through Blocks, and the people who have bought the book and left it on the night table might want to skip directly to that tool and use it about their morning pages. But I want to also say that using the tools, quote, badly, using them imperfectly, using them at all, will begin to move people forward. And that having been an artist myself, having had my own artistic heartbreaks, having written good books that didn't get bought, having done a feature film and then having my sound stolen, I know a lot about creative heartbreak and the survival of creative heartbreak, and that this book has been written from experience around pain, not from theory. I'm not a non-artist discussing the theory of creativity. I am an artist telling you, this is what I have learned to do about hemorrhaging. This is what I have learned to do about exhaustion. I think that we desperately need to share with each other, artist to artist, and that our society doesn't give us much chance to do that. And that my hope that people will work through the book in little clusters is so that we will have the opportunity of telling each other our stories, of saying, I wanted to have a job in publishing because I was scared to write my novel. And then that person maybe can keep that publishing job, but begin one page at a time to work on that book. We need to tell each other our U-turns. We need to tell each other the places where we lost faith and lost hope and weren't able to move through the gate because we had no support. I had a novel I wrote when I was 21. I sent it off to a lady who wrote for The New Yorker. She wrote back and encouraged me to publish it. My big sister sent the book to her boss at an advertising agency. He told my sister, nothing happens in this book. She told me that. Do you think that I followed the advice of the New Yorker writer? No, I put the book in a drawer. I never sent it anywhere. And so I have learned the cost of not having artistic recovery tools by paying that cost myself. So I didn't undertake any of this lightly. I want a tribe of artists. And it seemed to me that one way to get that tribe was to help people to recognize themselves as creatives.
I wonder if you can say more about the grief of uncovering dreams that you've put on the shelf or under the rug for years and years. What happens when you hit that spot and you think, you know, yeah, for the last 40 years I've been raising children and being a wife and taking care of other people's needs, and you know, this is horrible. I wasted my life. I can never get those years back.
People go through a period where their focus is on, I can never get those years back. And what I do and what the book does is say, what are you doing today? Did you do your morning pages? Have you done an artist date this week? What have you done of the 120 tasks in this book? Which one are you working on today that allows today to become more festive, more creative, more hopeful? And what happens is that when we turn around and face the past, there is a grieving process and the grief moves through us. Most of us are stuck in the past all the time. How terrible that we lost these opportunities, or we're stuck in the future when we're blocked and we're saying, the odds are this will never get made. What I'm trying to do is to get people to move into the present, and when they do, their dreams begin to actualize. Dreams can only be actualized in the present, and that's why the present is so frightening and exciting and fun, and something that when we are blocked, we tend to avoid. That's why people overwork, so they don't have, quote, the time to be creative. And then one day they turn around and say, I've used all my time. I'm saying, let's stop now. Let's start having the time.
It's almost like there's an implication in what you're saying, in that if you're a blocked creative person and you're stuck in your resistance, that this is a type of addiction all of its own, that by remaining blocked, it's similar to somebody who continues in a workaholic path without questioning it, or some other form of addiction. Do you think that's a fair conclusion to draw from what you're saying?
Yes. But again, I think that compassion is the answer, rather than, oh God, you are just completely addicted to not being creative. We are so quick to judge ourselves around our creativity. We judge ourselves for not doing it. We judge ourselves for doing it. We judge ourselves for doing it badly. We judge ourselves for not doing it as well as Fred. We have an enormous amount of judgment. What we need to have is compassion. We need to say, we live in an anti-artist culture. We have negative, damaging myths which we have osmotically taken into ourselves and which we subconsciously believe. Creativity frightened us in our family systems. Many of us have families frightened of creativity. Many of us believe that if we're creative, we're going to be broke, we're going to be crazy. We need to have some compassion and say, well, given all these variables, the miracle is that anybody's creative at all. And now that I'm looking at these variables, isn't it marvelous that I am begin to be able to be a little bit more creative? We have to lower the jumps and be extremely gentle and focused on encouraging ourselves for each tiny gain, and the tiny gains add up. We don't become blocked alone. It doesn't mean that if you've given up a dream, you're singularly neurotic and destructive. It just means that you have believed a great many things that you have been told, and you haven't yet been able to believe strongly enough in the inner voice and in the possibility of support for it. But that belief can be learned. and avoidance can be changed. And growth does happen. And artists recover.
In the artist's way, you introduce a concept called escape velocity. Mm-hmm. What is this?
Escape velocity is actually a very interesting thing. The term comes from my friend Michelle, who is a wonderful trial lawyer and also a wonderful radio personality now. She used to just be a lawyer, but she had a dream of being a radio performer, and it's 5 years later and she's doing both. That's just sort of a little success story. But we were talking about the way that as you move toward your dream, you seem to draw to you, something shows up to sabotage you. And I think a way that a lot of people can understand this is you have finally decided that you're going to break up with X, the rotten lover, who is the following negative things. And just as you are going to break up with X, X does this mysterious and temporary turnaround, showers you with exactly what you want, and you go back in for another 6 weeks, forgetting that X is really all those things that you were going to leave. So escape velocity is when you are moving out of the orbit of negativity and onto your own flight path, some test seems to show up that can be used one of two ways. Either you can say, oh-ho, this is the proof that I should not do this, you see? Or you can say, I must be achieving escape velocity, and this is just a little test that I have to pass in order to be able to keep going. It's just a very useful thing to know that as we begin to move kind of into what we might say into our power, into our optimism, we need to clear some of the leftover negativity, and it'll tend to show up right at that moment. And you can either say, oh, I give up, or you can say, aha, it's showing up. I must be doing something right.
Do you think there's some sort of creative leap of faith that needs to happen in the process of becoming an artist? That at some point you have to take this leap of faith?
No. When we talk about leaps of faith, we're usually really talking about tiny little hops. People are always making it very dramatic. If I'm going to be an artist, I have to get divorced. I have to live alone. I have to stay up all night. I have to drink a lot more black coffee. I have to have circles under my eyes. Maybe I should take up drugs again. And reality is, in order to be a creative person, you need to do creative things in your day. Most of us can find one small thing each day that we can do that fulfills us a little bit creatively. Those small things add up over time to huge changes. But we very seldom come into situations where we have to leap off the 49th floor. If we do come on that situation, we will find that the net is there.
The net is there. Have you found that in your own life in various circumstances?
I hate theory. I like practice. I like reporting. This is what I have learned through practice. This is what I've learned through 21 scripts and 4 plays and lots of poems and a great deal of work. This is what I've learned happens. When I teach it, I see that it happens to others. So when I say in the book that it's the act of commitment, the leap of faith, that creates the net, that's my experience. Very often we get it all backwards. We will want to know exactly how something's going to play out before we will commit to it. And I have learned that if you will commit to something, the how, or the net, will then appear. But we want it to appear before we commit. And it just does not work that way. Dramatic turns, while they're pretty interesting, are also pretty rare.
Julia, from doing this work for 25 years and teaching it for 15 years, can you say that you have faith in something related to this process? I mean, what's your faith?
Oh, I guess my faith is that God is an artist. So are we. And that we can cooperate with each other, and that creativity is what we are meant to be doing, and that doors do open for us, and that we are not given dreams in order to be thwarted and frustrated, that we are given dreams as guides, and that as we are willing to follow the guidance, we are moved into the territory of our heart. And I absolutely know this. I've watched it over and over and over. So yes, I think I have a faith in the artist's way.
This concludes Reflections on the Artist's Way with Julia Cameron.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.